Ilan Pape teaches political science at Haifa University and is the head of the Emil Tuma Institute for Palestinian Studies in Israel, has authored most recently A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples, was published by Cambridge. For those of you who have heard him before or read his writings, you know that Professor Pape is one of the more courageous, outspoken individuals in the academic world, which extends far beyond the Middle East. Welcome again to Takes on the World, Ilan Pape.
It's a pleasure to be on your show, Jeff.
Yes. Let's start with Ariel Sharon's proposed disengagement plan from Gaza, which has been postponed from July to August, and now I heard maybe postponed, I understand, until October because of the Jewish holidays. What is the status on that, and is there a chance, because even with proposed election or possible election of Hamas representatives by the Palestine Authority, that it might not happen?
Well, it's very difficult to say. I mean, one thing is for sure. Sharon does want to redeploy the Israeli forces and wants to take them out of Gaza because he thinks that there is an American assurance for his peace plan, or the so-called peace plan, which is that Israel does not have to control the Gaza Strip and most of, and half of the West Bank, and this would be accepted by the world as the end of the conflict. So he definitely wants to go along with the plan, but two things happened which he did not take into account. One is that the American call for democracy that was definitely reciprocated by some Palestinians shows us that indeed the forces like the Hamas are going to gain power and more power if indeed a full democratic process is going to take place in the occupied territories. So suddenly the disengagement can turn into a process which would allow the Hamas a stronghold in the Gaza Strip, which something that they did not predict. And secondly, I think that he miscalculated some of the pressures within his own party and his own ability to pass a policy which the grassroots in his own party object.
Well, in this instance, there is talk, I know, and particularly because of the postponement to August, that a number of American Jewish supporters, right wing of the settler movement, have come to Israel, have gone to Gaza. There has been talk in among critics, anti-Zionist critics in Israel, a debate whether or not this threat of a possible civil war or actual physical disruption or resistance within the army, particularly by religious soldiers, is serious or not.
Well, I don't think there is a serious threat of a civil war in Israel. I think there is an unholy alliance here between Sharon and the settlers, unlike between Sharon and his own Likud party. Sharon wants a traumatic withdrawal. He very much wants to create a national trauma, because he wants the disengagement to be the last ever Israeli withdrawal in the land of Palestine. So he's not intimidated by the fact that even extreme right-wingers would come from the United States and would even add more dramatic kind of background for the disengagement efforts. So I think that doesn't worry people, and one should differentiate between the discourse, which is about civil war and trauma and so on, which serves the Israeli propaganda, and the facts on the ground that indeed this would not be an easy operation, but it's a possible operation. And also most of the settlers know that paying a small price for the big prize, which is holding on to most of the West Bank as part of Israel, with probably American assurance. So we have to distinguish here between the charade and the real processes that take place on the ground.
Well, that goes back to an article that you wrote recently for the London Review of Books called Fortress Israel, which Israel really plans to build the world's largest ghetto, in a sense, to defend itself against or separate itself from the non-white peoples of the Middle East. And perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Yes, I will elaborate on this. I think it's very important for people to understand, because this is the context for most Israeli policies in the present and in the past. The basic idea of the Zionist project was to transplant in the middle of the Arab world what they called a Central European Republic. And it turned out that since they wanted to do it at the expense of the indigenous population of Palestine, it created hostility, objection, resistance, and eventually a series of regional wars. Now, the Israeli response to that was all the time to strengthen and fortify their military ability to stand against this kind of rejection, instead, for instance, of extending a hand and try to reconcile and find a peaceful solution with the neighborhood that they decided to build a house in by destroying someone else's house. And I think what happens is that with the time when the Israelis realize that there is a limit for how much territory they can take from Palestine and how much territory they can take from around the world in order to fortify their presence, they are more or less satisfied with the territorial space that they occupy now in the Middle East, but they think that the only way to uphold it is by building a huge wall and electric fences around Israel, and by that assuring that they are not going to be mixed with the regional population. The amazing thing, Jeffrey, is that, of course, there are Palestinians inside Israel. So if you take an airplane, as I did quite a long time ago, and you fly over Israel at a very high elevation, you can see that there are many Israeli settlements and Israeli kibbutzim and moshavim and little towns even, that they are themselves encircled by such walls and electricity now because they're afraid of being part of the Arab population, which is already in Israel. This you can see particularly where I live in the Galilee, where half of the population are Arabs. And this is an insane mentality that would lead to horrible consequences, because it means that the prime object of Israel is to keep a demographic superiority and majority. And this is impossible given the natural growth of the Arabs. This is impossible given the fact that the Zionist project was built in the midst of the Arab world. So the only way of keeping it is by ethnic cleansing, by throwing people out, and by building an enormous military apparatus that only alienates the area in which you are. And this can lead only to trouble in the future.
You actually compare the creation of Israel with the attempt by the Crusaders to re-Christianize the area.
In many ways, yes. Of course, historical comparisons always lack because there are similarities and dissimilarities. But what I was sort of studying the Crusaders period, and you can see the same sense of self-confidence at the midst of the Crusader project, where they felt that they were really part of Europe, although physically they were not part of Europe, because they built these castles and they built also a wall around the Crusader kingdoms, and they chased out people in the areas where the Europeans were settled, and they believed that that their military superiority, which indeed they had, would hold on forever. And in my article, I warned my fellow Jews in Israel that time is not on their side. In fact, if they continue to alienate, no matter how powerful the army will be, and no matter how strong the American support will be, eventually the Arab world and the Muslim world will find a way of swallowing them and really taking them out of the area in a way, unless they will find a way of reconciling with the area. And I also write in my articles that amazingly there's a lot of goodwill both in the Palestinian side and in the Arab world to accept a Jewish polity and a political entity in the midst of the Arab world, but there are certain conditions for that to happen, and definitely this could not be furthered by Israel serving as the bastion of American imperialism in the area, and this will not be served by the Israelis continuing the ethnic cleansing and the occupation that they already started 57 years ago.
Well, one of the things you said in closing of our last interview in February was that at this intifada, which was much more violent than the previous intifada, did not succeed, that what would come later would be far more serious.
I still stand by that prediction, I must say. In fact, as the days are passing by, I have a very strong sense that we are heading towards the third intifada, both sides are heading towards this, the next intifada with their with the knowledge that they are going there, but with the leadership not trying to do anything to stop it. And of course, I cannot predict when will it happen and how, what kind, what form will it take. But we have this historical sense that every uprising is worse than the previous ones, both in the way that it is being fought by the people who uprise, the people who revolt, the people who try to change, and far worse in terms of the retaliation by the occupying power. And it's amazing. You sit here, I, in another article I wrote in the London Review of Books many months ago, I said that I feel like a passenger in a plane without a pilot heading towards a collision. You can see the route. You can see how you're going there, and you know there's no pilot, and there's no one there to divert the aeroplane from the inevitable collision.
Well, getting back to the demographics which you mentioned, you begin the article on Fortress Israel with the question of the Palestinian right of return, the issue which in this country is seen as not being a very serious issue that the Palestinians raise is simply to create problems for Israel, as if there is nothing really inherently valid about the right of Palestinians who are still alive and their children to return to the country in which they were born. And you say, unless this is realized and understood, there will be no solution.
Exactly. I think and I'm glad you started by pointing out to the way that the right of return is being perceived in the United States. It's quite amazing. Since the creation of the State of Israel, the main Palestinian demands, the most important, the sacred demand of all the Palestinian demands, was never heard in the United States. And when it was heard, it was totally silenced and ridiculed and regarded as just a point of view of people who have no rationale, who have no common sense, and they represent a kind of a primitive, uncivilized world. And all the Israeli arguments were treated as very logical, very rational, very moral, and very ethical. In fact, the argument of the Palestinians, that since they were ethnically cleansed, they have the right to return, and that without recognition of that right, and the implementation of that right, there will be no solution, is recognized by the State Department everywhere else in the world. If you look at the State Department website, and I encourage your listeners to do that, it's quite an interesting exercise, which I did. You go to the State Department website on the Internet. You search for ethnic cleansing, and you get many documents. The most important of them are those who define ethnic cleansing. And you will see how exactly the ethnic cleansing in the Balkans relates to the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Then you have a document how the State Department defines as the only reasonable solution for cases of ethnic cleansing. And the first item is unconditional return of those who were ethnically cleansed. Now, this is rational in the eyes of the State Department to everywhere in the world today, apart from one place, Palestine. And I think that this shows us what the late Edward Said tried all his life to refute, what he called the veil that was cast on the Palestinian issue, on the Palestinian point of view. I mean, at least from, you know, a logical point of view, both sides should have had a fair hearing. I mean, we should hear the Israeli side, but we should, in the United States, equally be able to hear the Palestinian side. And this disparity between the Israelis possessing all the wisdom and all the morality on their side, and the Palestinians are only on the wrong, is so difficult to refute, and I'm glad you bring it up. And I think that's the reason why a very humane, a very reasonable demand of the Palestinians is regarded the way it is regarded. And finally, it doesn't really matter how the Americans or the American establishment conceives it. Without the implementation of the right of return, all the political arrangement between the elites have no value. They will not lead to any genuine reconciliation, and they will not bring an end to the conflict. On the contrary, they will create the impression that we were moving towards a solution, and then, as happened in the summer of 2000, because the refugee problem would not be dealt with, the solution will not be accepted by the Palestinian side, and there will be all the frustration on both sides that would lead to another cycle of violence.
One of the problems we have to deal with, and by the way, my guest is Ilan Pappe, is that in even the progressive movement, progressive Jewish groups, and most of the many of the pundits who speak on the alternative media think the right of return is not a realistic demand, that the Palestinians shouldn't actually give it up but not expect to see it achieved, which is essentially the same thing. And it has not been taken, other than Palestinian groups, and even some Palestinian leaders even here have, or would-be Palestinian leaders, have said it's not realistic. It's very difficult to get that issue taken seriously in the United States.
I agree. And I think one of the things that should be stressed, that the issue of the right of return is connected to the demographic issue in Israel. And I think that may help people to understand why it is a valid issue and why the return itself is a valid solution. And I'll explain it in two or three sentences. Because the Israelis are obsessed with maintaining a demographic majority, namely, they'll do all they can, including transfer and ethnic cleansing, they already did it in the past, in order to maintain a Jewish majority. And because this goal is unattainable, because of the natural growth, because of the way the Israelis see the future map of Israel, one way or another, even without the return of the refugees, Israel one day will not have a Jewish majority. It's definitely going to lose a solid Jewish majority in the very near future, which means that it cannot continue to be an ethnic Jewish state, given the fact that democratically it could not be sustained. Therefore, once the Israelis would understand, or the world will make them understand, that you cannot be an ethnocracy, namely a country that have an ethnic majority by violent means, and a democracy. Once it is realized, the number of Arabs or Jews in a future country is not important anymore. And if you add to this that this is a demand that can make Israel live in peace, not, or the Jews in Israel, live in peace, not just with the Palestinians, but with the Arab world at large. And think about it even further. This also means that you have the way to stabilizing the Middle East, because this is the main issue that troubles the relationship between the Arab world and the West. In fact, this is the issue that troubles the relations between the Muslim world and the West. And once you have the key, and the key is the refugee issue and the right of return, any talk about inability to implement it means that people want the conflict in Palestine to continue, the trouble between America and the Middle East to continue, and the kind of clash of civilization between the Muslim world and the rest of the world to continue. The people who don't want this to continue should go first and foremost to the Palestinian refugee problem. There it started. This is the core of the problem. It's very easy to solve it. It's a humane issue, not only a political issue, and every reasonable and moral person in the world should support that solution.
One thing I found interesting in your article is how you mentioned it isn't so much even being Jewish is so important for Jews from European and American background, but the white skin, because when Jews, Sephardic and Mizraim for the Middle East, dark-skinned Jews were brought in to Israel to replace the Palestinians as cheap labor back after the creation of the state. They were treated in a racist way as second-class citizens. And in fact, that was what Likud used to get in power, because I remember reading statements by many of so-called progressive Israelis, Ashkenazi, who were supporting Palestinian rights, but they would speak disparagingly of the Arab Jews.
Absolutely. You see, it all started with the fact that before Zionism, Jews defined themselves as being on a religious way. They said, we are not Christians or we are not Muslims. What Zionism did by transferring the Jewish identity onto the land of Palestine in the midst of the Arab world, that being a Jew meant not being an Arab. But after the Holocaust, and because of the lack of Jewish immigration from European countries, the Jewish leadership decided to allow 1 million Jews from the Arab world to immigrate to Israel. Now, suddenly you had Arab Jews And the only definition of a Jew was that you were not an Arab. So you had to de-Arabize these Arab Jews, and that means you already treated them as inferior citizens. The same happened to the Palestinian citizen inside Israel. They did not match to this idea of a Jewish citizen. And suddenly we found out, after the Russian immigration, or the immigration from the ex-Soviet Union, that what really mattered to the Israeli authorities was not whether the people who came from the ex-Soviet Union and its satellites were Jews or not. This was not important. What was important, that you had here a massive group of people who were not Arabs. And this is what now the exclusion and inclusion acts is in Israel. If you want to be a full citizen, if you want to be part of the state, you have to be not an Arab. But the fact that there are so many who fall into the definition of Arabs shows the kind of problems that faces Israel. And this is why I think that after the Israelis would solve their own problem, whether they want to be a democratic country or they want to be a theocracy, once they solve that problem, it would be easier to understand their positions on the right of return.
Speaking of the demographics, there was recently a conference at your university on this issue, which is at the center, and I should get into this, of a boycott of your university, Haifa University, and Bar Ilan University, which was opened or recognized a campus on the West Bank by the British Teachers Union. And perhaps you could comment on that.
Yes. Let me start with the AUT decision,
yes.
the Association of University Teachers in Britain. The AUT or activists within the AUT are part of segments in the European civil society that ever since April 2002, ever since the massacre in Jenin, have tried to gather forces and to think of the best ways of ending the Israeli occupation. Many of them are veterans of the anti-apartheid movement and veterans of other civil causes that united people beyond borders and beyond nations. And these people saw now the occupation in Palestine as the prime object. They came to the conclusion after studying the South African case that sanctions and boycott and external pressure is probably, for the time being, the only means by which you can get the Israelis to end the occupation. Part of that campaign was the idea of an academic boycott. They tried in 2004 to pass us a resolution and failed, succeeded in 2005, but did not succeed in passing a principled resolution to boycott the Israeli academia, and had to be satisfied for tactical reasons with two universities. And one of the universities was my own university, and my own case, mainly the way that the university tries to silence me, was singled out as the reason for boycotting my own university. I think it would have been better to go for a principled decision had it been possible, but this is a tactical decision of my comrades in Britain, and they should know better how to push these things forward. And I do hope in time to get these more principled and moral position formulated in a way that could enlist even more people. The thing is that my university, so typical to my university, in order to show that indeed it's not only the way that I am silenced that should single it out as a university that deserves a special treatment. A few days after the AUT decision was taken, a horrible conference took place on the campus. This is a conference, supposedly an academic conference, under the blessing and the auspices of the university authorities, that talked about the Arabs in Israel as a demographic problem. The subtext was that if the Arabs are a demographic problem, the way to deal with a demographic problem, of course, is transfer. And this is all within an academic debate, which is, as I said, singled out by the university as an event that the management support. I wrote letters, for example, showing how in Germany, in the late 1920s and early 1930s, the Jews were first regarded as a demographic problem. And we know what the solution that the Germans found when they decided that the Jews were a demographic problem. Now, this association, this horrible language, somehow doesn't ring a bell among most of my colleagues. And I think it shows how culpable is the Israeli academia in general in the way that it supports and helps to maintain the occupation, either by directly being involved in it, and worse, maybe, by being silent about it.
People said it's unfair to boycott Israeli universities because the universities are the heart of the resistance to the occupation, and that has not, at least from over here, been my experience. There are a number of academics such as yourself, but I think you're a relative handful in terms of academia there. How would you classify the role that the Israeli Academy has played in maintaining the occupation and the justification for it?
No, I certainly share your analysis. To my knowledge, there are about 9,000 faculty members all around Israel. I and a friend of mine once tried to find out how many are really actively involved in even voicing strong opposition to the occupation, let alone being active in any kind of activity that can show that you're against the occupation. And we came to the dismal number of 100 at best. And we really extended the definition of an anti-occupation person. We really were very liberal about it. I mean, anyone who just said something was included in our estimation. Namely, we're talking here about less than 1% of the whole Israeli academia, so I think it's ridiculous to talk about. I just read an article in The Nation that says that my own university is the headquarters of the activity against the occupation, the headquarters of the resistance movement to the occupation. I think this person must have seen films about Che Guevara or anything. I mean, this is unbelievable that anyone who knows anything about the universities in general, and my university in particular, would really attach such an adjective to what goes on. Unfortunately, the Israeli academia, as I said, mostly by being indifferent, mostly by being silent, are very quiet about things that are done in their name. And secondly, as academics, they have moral obligation to stand out, hold the mirror in front of their society and tell them this cannot be done, not by a state that claims to be the representative of the ultimate victim of the 20th century, the Jewish people.